Welcome back to the Passion for Craft podcast. We're doing our first remote episode today. Dad, what do you want to talk about first? Do you want to talk about France, or do you want to talk about school?
Well, the thing that's hot on my mind is France.
I wonder why.
For you listeners out there, we got this trip planned to go to France. I mean, a great trip.
An awesome trip.
Seeing all these historic sites and looking at all this stuff. I got to the airport and my passport expired in June. And turns out France requires a 90-day time period before your passport expires. And I missed it by 10 days. And so by the time we chased everything around and looked at everything, we just said, look, I can't get there now until like Tuesday or Wednesday. And, you know, it was just a mess. And the itinerary is going. And we were talking to Jackson and Natalie and just like, you guys need to just go. It's an incredible trip. And, you know, we'll see if we can get refunds. And anyway.
And y'all did. Y'all actually got a good amount of refunds. Y'all got, you know, better than you would have thought. Better than I would have thought. You're like, no, not at all.
Yeah. So now the question is, I haven't even talked to you about the trip except for when we were just talking about it on the phone. Tell us about the trip, damn it. You know, I think knowing that Jackson had a great time, you know, it reinforces to me how important travel is and how you learn so much by going to other countries, by looking at original architecture that we try to emulate here in the U.S. And so, okay, brag about the trip, Jackson.
It was an amazing trip. We had an awesome time. Something kind of funny about this trip, Natalie and I both were just kind of like focused on life. Like, Natalie's pregnant. We've got a 2-year-old. So life is crazy. And I'm at school. A lot of stuff going on right now. And Natalie and I are looking at this trip as like, this is going to be a great escape. We're going to like, you know, get to relax. We're going to get to whatever. And we're going with you guys. So I'll just not really focus on the trip until we're there, and I'll just follow along, and that'll be great. So we're on our way to the airport, and I get a call. I can't get out of the country. This is crazy. Passport expired. And Natalie and I look at each other, and we're like, okay. So we hang up the phone, and we're like, okay, we got to figure out what's actually going on this trip. Like, we got to actually, like, for the first time,
pay attention
to, you know, what we're doing, where we're going, where we need to be, and when, because we had all these tours lined up. So before we dive in, all of these tours are like totally not standard. So we went to Paris day one, and then we went to Normandy. And when we went to Normandy, our contact in Normandy, Natalie's mom's a travel agent, so she kind of hooked us up with this travel agent who's in the area, and she is amazing. She knows like everyone in Normandy and really hooked us up. But the way she really hooked us up is because Brent is Brent. So it was basically like they sent everyone your videos. Oh, Austin, sorry, this is just a minor thing before I continue. Is my laundry machine like clanging?
No.
Every door was open on this trip because of you and your reputation. And so it was really funny getting to all these places because we would get there and they would go, you're the architect. And I would go, no. Here's what happened. And so basically I'm like telling all these people his passport expired. I didn't know just how many doors your name opened until day one when we got there. So like the first little bit, we were in Paris and we like did a bunch of tours in Paris, did Notre Dame and like all this cool stuff. It was amazing. We like, but that was not like the heart of the trip. The heart of the trip was really to like see Normandy and see this historic region in France and really beautiful architecture and really amazing chateaus. The Normandy region is like where a lot of, yeah, just really nice chateaus are. For the uninitiated, I didn't know this. A chateau is like originally was a castle, and like the word literally translates to castle in French, but it was then later in like the 17th century, 16th, 17th, it started to like have this trend towards being just a summer home. And so the city of Paris just stank. And so it was a summer home that all these like rich people would go to. And wow, there's a lot I want to say. Okay, got to get organized here. But okay, so your name opened a lot of doors. I didn't realize it until we got to the first place, the first chateau we went to. It says like, come see this tour of this chateau and then have a light lunch. So we get there and like we're having like drinks, like just like light drinks, like cocktail attire, but it's four people. It's me, Natalie, and then the Tujou like family. And so we're like, all right, cool. They're like showing us their place. It's amazing. It's really beautiful. But they're like, well, it's Blint. What is he doing? And we're like, oh, he had a passport trouble. And the guy was like, oh, he should have called me. I can make one call. He is here tomorrow. And I was like, oh, I didn't know who we were working with. Like, I didn't know the level of people that were like, let me just make a call and he'll be here. But anyway, so that was like,
it's interesting to me that that the country house tradition is strong in France, just like it's strong in England. And, you know, the English country house, Palladian and beautiful and influenced a lot of American architecture. The chateau for the aristocrats, for that world is pretty much the same, right? That those became summer homes to get out of the city.
Yeah, so this family, the first family that we saw, they were super influential in American history. They were the Tujou family, Tujou. I think it's Tujou. That's like how they were saying it. And they were Benjamin Franklin's contact with the French, who they basically were the ones who were the French treasury guys. And they told Benjamin Franklin, all right, you got the green light because we're friends and because like George Washington was winning and there was like, you know, positive turns. That was the reason that the American Revolution even like happened. And it was kind of funny. The guy made a passing comment. He was like, yeah, we helped you guys start a revolution and then they revolutioned on us. So, you know, it was like, oh.
So for those of you who don't know American history, the French were very influential and it was the French involvement finally that helped help us defeat the British. There's a lot of things. There's a lot of politics going on back and forth and, you know, influence and trade and other things that when the French came in and decided to trade with us and recognized us, you know, right, it was kind of a big deal. And then at the same time, you know, we're 1776 to 1781, basically. Their French Revolution, where the guillotine and they chopped off the head of Louis the 16th and all that, you know, that's what he was talking about. So what is that? You know, 10, 15 years later, their revolution, which was much more violent, much more chaotic. And then Napoleon comes in and kind of, you know, ends that era. But anyway. And then, of course, we buy Louisiana because of Napoleon's money problems. We're able to buy Louisiana from Napoleon for a song. Yeah.
So there's like some really cool stuff that happened that I didn't realize, because I guess the question I was like eating me up was like, where did these guys' money come from? Because everyone had these homes, or like not everyone, but like these homes we were going to were massive and they had all this stuff. And so from the early ages, what would happen is you had one mill and the mill was located on the chateau ground or on the abbey ground. And abbeys were kind of like a little bit of a protest to the monarchy in a lot of ways. Like they did stuff different. They held elections, like very interesting system, but you could get your mill. Like once you harvested your grain, you could only use the mill to like process the grain in one of two places. And you had to pay a fee whenever you did. And the same thing was true. Like the same thing happened whenever you would plant grain, like wherever you planted on, you had to pay a tax to use that land, processing the grain. And then actually like it was like a early days vertical monopoly that these aristocrats who owned this land had on everything. And then the abbeys, there was kind of a similar system, but it was more like religion based. So like if you wanted your son or daughter to be successful, you would either sell them off to the Abbey, you would give them a piece, you would give the Abbey some of your land and then say, here's my daughter. And so the Abbeys would amass like all these lands, and they were, every Abbey we went to was like super decadent and super amazing. And then inside of the Abbeys, it was like Benedictine monks. So like the most strict monks, they couldn't talk. They couldn't like laugh. You know, there's all these things that they couldn't do, but they're in these like ornate, elaborate, like super wealthy buildings.
Well, that's really interesting. That whole, I know more about it in England and France, but the French are much more Catholic than English, and the English were mm-hmm. they kicked out the Catholic Church in like 1663. And there was a the English did, and became the Anglican Church, no longer Catholic. And one of the things that you see in English architecture is, you know, friends of the king and people of wealth, where those abbeys were, taking that abbey, those abbey buildings, and even that stone that had been used to build those abbeys, and it became like the building box for a lot of the great estates around England, because, you know, the church was gone. But I mean, you figure that for, you know, 200 to 400 years, that the church was it. And so they, you know, had the wealth, and they had the thing to build the abbeys and do all that stuff. So
like you were saying, French is very Catholic, like France is very Catholic. They stomped out that Protestant revolution. Like when Martin Luther came along, nailed the 95 Theses, the English, it like turned into a revolution. And in France, by the time it got to France, it was like quashed pretty quickly and pretty heavily. So the majority of the nation is still very Catholic.
Well, the Huguenots, which were the Presbyterians and the Calvinists in France, were kicked out. They were persecuted by the Catholics, and they were kicked out. And that Huguenot exodus massacre that took place, a lot of very skilled craftsmen went to England and to America and to Switzerland. I was just listening to an Acquired, the one on Rolex. And one reason why Geneva and Switzerland was such a mecca for watchmakers and things like that is when the Huguenots went out of France, a lot of them went to Switzerland, and you had this high concentration of very skilled people, you know, and that Huguenot, you know, exodus from France was detrimental for them and a benefit to a lot of other things.
One thing you said, them using a lot of the stones from the Abbey, the stones were like a very influential thing. It seemed like our tour guide was very proud because he was from the Caen area, which there's a quarry there. And so he was like, you can tell this is a Caen stone because it's very, very creamy. Like it's this creamy color, and it's not like the stark white color. So like he was recognizing the stones based on the region, and they would like, dude, it was one of the craziest things seeing how much they rebuilt, and they would like take down full stone buildings. Like when you think of a permanent structure, you think of like a stone building, and it'll be there until it turns into rubble. But like they are taking apart piece by piece stone buildings and then putting them back up again into equally ornate, equally amazing stone buildings. So a lot of times, like when we would be at these places, we would go, you know, how long has this been here? Or like, how old is this? And they're like, well, the foundation was built in the 1100s. Then this part was redone. This part was taken down. This has stayed the same since 13, whatever. And it was like, one, all the dates, right? Like, are you saying 11? Like 1100?
Yeah.
And you know, one of the earlier ones we went to was 1012. So really, really early. One kind of funny thing about that, I was asking about one place I thought looked really old, and I was like, this is super old. My tour guide was like, young, very young. And I was like, what? And I asked the other, like, so we had like our tour guide who was like kind of a translator with us, and then we had like the people who were showing us around the places who like had ownership of the places. So then I kind of turned to the owner of the place. I was like, he's saying this is young. How old is this? He's like, oh, very young. Maybe early 18th century. And, you know, that's so funny because that's America. That's pre-America. Early 18th century, America does not exist. It's a colony. So very different culture when they're like, is that old? You know,
what was your favorite style or favorite building there?
François Mansart.
The architect?
I've lost my pronunciation of it. Yes. anything he did was awesome to me. I really like the Mansard Roof, I think. We saw the, what is it? Man, I can't remember. Oh, Chateau Balleroy. That's the name of it. Chateau Balleroy. Very, very cool. Owned by the Balleroy family for a while. And then Martin Forbes, whenever he went to World War II, saw a painting that he really liked at this chateau. Chateau was occupied. Like a lot of these places were like occupied during World War II. And so while it was kind of ironic, we went to Normandy, but not to see the beaches. We got like a taste of the history because a lot of them were occupied during these times. Like, oh, a tank hit this and this roof fell down. Oh, tank. But the Martin Forbes went back after World War II ended to the Chateau Balleroy and he goes to buy a painting. But instead he came back home with a chateau. And so that was like the joke. You left to go buy a painting, came back with a chateau. And the Forbes family loved this chateau and the people of the town surrounding it loved the family. The chateau was in like a really interesting like period where when it was built with a dry moat around it. And so it's kind of like, wait, why would a dry moat be here? And I was like, how do you know it's a dry moat? They're like, there's no river around. Like they weren't diverting a river to be like surrounding their house. They're in a valley, or no, they weren't even in a valley. It was kind of like they were up here and then the valley was down. So it was like, there's no water. It was always dry. Like, I was like, okay, well, like what's the trend? Well, in the time period when these were summer homes versus castles, the style was changing and they were like, well, let's keep the moat because it's a cool feature, but it's not necessary. It was so interesting though. Like you'd go into the bottom, like the basement of the chateau, and there's a door leading out into the moat where you can just walk around. So like, wow, that's kind of crazy. Very, very interesting house. Martin Forbes bought it. And then another guy, Roy, I can't remember his name. Anyway.
Roy D. Mercer. Is it Roy?
How big a boy are you?
Was it R.D. Yeah. Mercer?
Not Roy D. Mercer. It was Edelman, Roy Edelman, Edelman. Anyway, his foundation owns it now because he passed in 2022. And so we were shown around by one of the ladies who helps run the foundation. She was amazing. Her husband's receiving an award in Chicago for architecture that he did. I don't know, like this past week.
Interesting.
So she was like steeped in historic architecture and like really liked it and had a huge passion for it. But this chateau was super well preserved because in the 20th century, when Martin Forbes bought it, he restored like a lot of it and like brought it back. But oh my goodness, the carvings that they did in this chateau were insane. Like, I feel like I've seen some really cool carvings and like really ornate carvings and other stuff like that. But like outside of Versailles or like a true palace where it's like king's money, I've never seen this ornate of a carving. Like the one that sticks out in my mind, there was like an eagle that was like a foot sticking down out of the ceiling in a room that was like a panel. So it wasn't even like, oh, we're just going to put an eagle on this side of the wall. It was like, this is just a panel in the ceiling. Like it was like a part of the ceiling.
What is, tell us about Notre Dame. I mean, you went into a restored Notre Dame.
Notre Dame's crazy.
Did you, because you went when we were kids. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And the thing I think of when I look at it is how clean that stone looked, how white it is inside there.
Wait, you remember from 2010?
No, like I remember. I saw from pictures of the restored one. It looks like a brand new building in there.
You know why? It's because it's so lit up. Previously, it wasn't lit up. So it was so dark. Our tour guide was like, oh, look at this. Whenever they reopened, I never noticed in all the years that I've been tour guiding that ceiling detail. Like the keystone in that arch has a decorative detail hanging down from it, an angel or a demon or something. And she was like, I never noticed that. They lit the place up. So that was one of the things where they definitely cleaned everything because it was smoke filled and everything. But they actually turned up the lights in the building now, which is starting to be a trend with a lot of these cathedrals. One thing that like I think needs some fact checking, I'm not 100,000% sure on it, like enough to go into more depth, but they built a lot of these Notre Dame cathedrals. So like the Notre Dame cathedral itself may have been additioned onto or whatever, but the core of the building was actually made in a bunch of different regions all around France. And so there are like six of them that are like similarly sized.
Are you talking about just cathedrals or are you talking about Notre Dame?
I mean, like the way that Notre Dame is designed, like that style of cathedral.
It's a common building technique.
Notre Dame's architect, control C, control V, like popped it in to other places. And something very interesting about it that like the reason that that even matters is because Notre Dame was built in 120 years. So it took 120 years for them to finish Notre Dame. That was abnormal because of a lack of funding. So a lot of times you get in your head like, oh, Notre Dame, like the people who built this, the craftsmen who are involved in this, they spent their whole lives working on this one building to like make it. Well, a lot of similarly sized cathedrals built around the region of France took 12 years, 6 years, like not very long in comparison. But because Notre Dame was built in France, whether it was the money needed to be diverted to other projects or, you know, just Paris being a bigger city, it didn't have all of the same funding as like a dedicated, we need a cathedral for this town. Let's focus our energy and let's get it done. It was, we'll dip our fingers into it for a little while and then we'll move on to something else. And then it was iterated on, of course, like it was expanded.
So there's a... There's a Ken Follett novel called Pillars of the Earth. I think it's called Pillars of the Earth. And it's all about building a cathedral. And yeah. I did a deep dive into cathedral and cathedral architecture and building cathedrals because I was enamored by that whole idea of, you know, the craftsmen. And like you say, if it, you know, 100 years wasn't unheard of as far as building right. cathedrals. And, you know, some cathedrals you'll see actually have a change in style that it'll start out one way, but then the towers, when they go up, might look a little bit different because, yeah. you know, styles changed. But, you know, there was stories of cathedrals falling and killing people and things like that. So it doesn't surprise me that there was a control, you know, control V paste function because it was so hard and it took so long. If there was a proven technique that worked, you know, they would have done it over and over again because of these walls that they were building up. But it's pretty fascinating, the whole story. And his book, Ken Follett, is a spy novelist. I mean, he's like a, and so it reads like a great story. And it's basically the story of this craftsman and the building of the architecture and kind of some of the things that work and don't work and what's different in France versus England. And yeah. It's pretty cool. It's pretty interesting. Yeah, no, that's cool. And Michael Burry, your second year instructor, actually worked on it. And so, yeah, that's pretty cool. I mean, there was a connection that's there. Cool. And then, of course, you were in there. Did you go upstairs or look at anything?
We didn't go upstairs. I really wanted to. I don't know how much that was restoration based or how much that was time based because we spent a long time going through the cathedral. Also, it was brand new open. So it was like, a lot of people were there. The hack, though, oh my gosh, go in the morning.
Really?
By like, yeah, we were there on a Saturday, 8:30. Maybe it was it Friday or Saturday? Do you remember?
I thought you were there Friday.
Okay, we were there on a Friday. So I guess that's part of it. But still, like, we were there on a Friday. And
it might have been Saturday now to think about it.
We got there at 9, and it was not crowded at all. Like, there are these huge lines, like, you know, 100 yards, and it zigzags like 9 times, and you've got to like go through that whole thing. And when we were passing it at like 6 p.m. on the night before, it was full, like full, and then a crowd waiting to go through this like huge line. So a lot of people want to go see this thing. And I was like, no way there's that many people. So we go the next morning, we get there at like 9 a.m. She did a thing like around the outside around 8:30. By about like 9:15, we're walking in the cathedral. We're like zigzagging this thing because there's no one in line. So go in the morning. That was like totally the hack.
Travel hack.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
But then by, you know, 11:15, 12, by the time we were leaving, I was like, let me do one more pass. I want to get some photos of this stuff. This is crazy. And I just want to take it in. And so I left. Natalie needed a break. So she's sitting with a tour guide. And but I could not move through the crowd that was gathered inside the cathedral, you know, 2-3 hours later.
So, I mean, you know, if you look back on that trip, I suspect it'll stay with you for a very, very long time. I told you that when I was, I think I was at North Bennett Street, my dad, who was a consultant for Baxter Pharmaceuticals, had a trip over there. My mom couldn't go, so I got to go with him. I got to wander around London for, and I think I went out to Bath for about 4 or 5 days with him on that trip, kind of a boondoggle and kind of a trip that I really never forgot and wanted to mean, I wanted to keep going back. I still want to go back. And so, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, one, it was that kind of trip for you, but two, the real thing that I'm hoping is that guys who are listening, you got to figure out a way to get over there. You got to figure out a way to go. And I'm talking, just go walk around those cities. I mean, Paris, I think, is the most beautiful city in the world, or one of them anyway. You can learn and get so much inspiration just walking around. It's just crazy how they organize squares and how they build buildings and, you know, the quality of the millwork and just the stonework and the carving. It's so inspiring.
One thing that just stuck with me already in reflecting about the trip, like, I love the Chateau-esque style. So, like, that was really big, getting to see, like, firsthand these really beautiful chateaus. In Paris, one of the more staggering things is how the country of France has handled these beautiful historic things. Because I think we in America don't do a great job of handling a lot of our historic stuff. And I think there's like this weird balance, because a lot of the Parisians were like, oh, there's so much red tape around this stuff. Like, you don't want to register it as a historic landmark because there's so many more hoops you need to jump through. In fact, there's a story of a guy who owned a chateau who had his chateau registered as a historic landmark, wanted to do some improvements on it, deregistered it, did the improvements, and then re-registered it because there's like so much red tape to go through. So it's an interesting balance, but I really think they handled that balance well, especially in like the chateaus, because one of the things that's so like vocal about this architecture is how they manage space. Because I think we don't think about like medieval streets and how they would be like overhung, like the building cantilevered out floor over floor to where you can touch your neighbor's window. And so you kind of have these like old favelas that you're walking through and you're like seeing no daylight breakthrough and all this stuff. And so when you would go to these chateaus, they have like a yard, and the yard is perfectly manicured. The bushes are manicured, like the placement of the plants are manicured, and it's like so thought through. But then the space being maintained, I think, is what is so important to something that speaks about the architecture. Like, there's this idea of a hôtel particulier is what they're called. Basically, it's like a chateau in the city, is how they described them. And a lot of times what you would do to build like the perfect hôtel particulier is you would buy a street, okay? And you would, your entrance to the house would be on one side of, you know, the street. And then you would block off the other side of the street, and your house would be that blocked off side of the street, and you would have a courtyard in the middle so that carriages could turn around. But also, whenever you would walk through these tight cobblestone streets of Paris, and then you would turn a corner into a hotel particulier, oh, it's so light, it's so airy, and then you're able to appreciate like all the detail and the fine work that's like done on the home. And so I think we, like, New York City, I think, is a great example of a once historic city that has now turned into a concrete jungle, quite literally, where, yes, that's amazing, but at the same time, it doesn't hold as much weight when you're just like, I'm surrounded by buildings. You don't really, like, focus in on one or the other. Like, I do think there are things that make buildings stand out, but I don't know. It feels different. There's also like a building height limit in a lot of the cities. And I know we have that in America, but it's just different.
Well, that's like, one of the things. That's one of the stories. Things about Paris. There are no high rises except outside the city. And there's a uniform height. One reason I think it's beautiful is because there is a limit. Washington, D.C. Yeah. also has a limit on how high you can build buildings. That concept that you're talking about is something that, you know, the public square that the Italians first started doing when they started clearing their areas was because the medieval city was a mess, right? The streets were, you know, there wasn't a grid or a layout of streets. It was all just these winding, you know, meandering paths where, like you were saying, houses touch each other. And the Great Fire of London in 1666 was partly due to the fact that those houses were so close together. And St. Paul's and some of those areas that came out of that after that fire. But you look at any classical city like Italy, you know, what you're describing in Paris, you know, that there is a desire for order. Okay. And in our world and in our era, you know, I don't think people appreciate form, order, because it is the opposite. It fights against chaos and ugly. And so I look at, you know, one of my, you know, people know that I rail on ugly houses and ugly buildings because I think it's lazy. I think it's not creating order. It's chaos. And so you're just seeing the most beautiful example of that order when they took those medieval towns and they created the public square. They created order and symmetry and balance. And, you know, those were important concepts and important yeah. things that I think we've forgotten, but you were able to experience firsthand.
One thing that our guide said, like on that note, which I thought was really interesting. Day one, we had like an unbelievable tour guide. It was supposed to be like a capture Paris, like walk around tour. It was like a 3-hour, 4-hour tour. And we were just walking around the city and he was just going to deliver some highlights. So he went into like so much detail and gave so much historical context. He was great. I also feel like on these trips, if you can spring for a guide in some way, shape or form, one of your days you're there, it is so helpful because there was days where we had a guide and days where we didn't. And the days where we didn't, we still learned stuff and we were still taking in so much. But the day we had the guide, it was like you were getting these inside secrets and inside tips on a lot of stuff. One of the things he kept harping on was we would turn a corner and he'd go, notice, what do you see about the street here? We got a square corner. That means that this is a rich area because it was planned. And then we'd go 3 streets away and he'd go, notice, that corner's at a, you know, 35-degree angle. These are unorganized streets. These are winding streets. These are unplanned.
Yeah, that's this interesting.
Is a poorer area. So that was really helpful. I mean, he also had a crazy thing in a lot of like the underpasses where you would have a carriage driving on a road, and it would go under a rooftop, some sort of awning. They would use timbers instead of stones. So timbers turned up on end. And they would make less of a loud noise whenever the carriage would pass over it. So it didn't echo stone up into your thing. Like little details like that. I was like, that's crazy. Who knew that?
I don't understand that. What do you mean they'd use timbers?
So like, you know, you've got a cobbled street.
They would use timbers for the street?
Instead of having the cobbled stone in the street underneath like a lot of these homes, you would drive through the front entryway. But in order to make the most of the space, part of the covering, there would be rooms above where you would drive under. And so on that underpass area, they would take a 4x4 and they'd cut it up into little timbers and they would use those as the stones for the underpass. Because they're sheltered from water, right? So they're not going to get as water damaged.
They cut logs into stones.
That's right. But yeah.
Kind of.
They just cut a 4x4 on end.
Yeah.
So the grain's facing upwards. And
do you have a picture of that?
Mortar around it. Another thing that I think is interesting about the cities that you were saying, they did not have organized sewage system until really recently. Like, I don't remember how recently, but I want to say like 1800s. Like,
oh, I'm sure it's later than that.
Kind of crazy.
Yeah.
Also, did you know this before we go back to sewage? Just what would you say? When would you say the most recent beheading was? Public execution by guillotine.
I mean, probably late 1800s, early 1900s.
1960 something.
Wow. Wouldn't have thought that late.
Really recent. One of our tour guides was like, oh yeah, I remember. There were parties. I was a kid, but it was crazy. We're like, oh my God.
Are these criminals they were doing, or who are they executing?
I don't know. I didn't really ask. Whenever they said they chopped someone's head off, I was like, I'm not going to mess with the French.
Yeah, that's crazy.
But like, that's so recent. Like, if someone can remember it, you're like, oh, geez.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, I mean, sewage in America wasn't figured out for a long time. Chicago, you know, the river ran into Chicago and they kept putting sewage in it. It was just a mess. Probably until the early, I think 1920 or 30. I mean, it was a long time before they figured it out.
I think Paris is still trying to work it out. I mean, they had, you know, the Olympics conundrum. They were tossing stuff into the Seine for a while.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, if you remember the news stories, they didn't know if people could swim in there because
People were pooping in it because they were like, no, keep it dirty. You remember that?
No, I don't remember that.
Yeah, it was crazy. People were upset that the mayor of Paris was like, no, we're going to get it clean and I'm going to swim in it. And then the mayor never swam in it, but people like pooped in it in response to that because they're like, keep it dirty. It was a weird deal. But one of the interesting things, like, they built the city wind, like if you were downwind or upwind, you were in a more rich area. That's something we never consider in terms of like, would you ever even think, oh, when I'm building a new home, I want to make sure that it's in this area because of the smell?
Well, I mean, if you think like Mobile, Alabama, there's a paper mill there and you want to be, you know, on the other side of that. So
I guess I don't think about industrial towns like that. That is a big thing.
So Paris or out Normandy, do you like better?
Normandy.
Paris
was nice because I think we had more free time. And like just time with ourselves. Normandy was great, but our driver like ate lunch with us every day. And Natalie and I were like,
in a good way or a bad way?
Well, day one, it was like, this is great. And then day two, we were like, why are you eating with us? Because he would like just sit down at the restaurant with us. And it's like, we're like tucked away in this small, like Northern France city at a cafe. And we're like, oh, we're going to have a cute romantic lunch. And then he's like, table for three? And we're like, oh, okay, sure. He just kind of invited himself. We asked our tour guide and they're like, yeah, because you're like paying them for the whole day, it's like expected that they are a part of your meals, kind of. But typically the courtesy is they ask. And then usually people are like, yeah, come on. But I don't know. It was awkward. It was fine. It was like every time we sat down, Nellie and I are like, let's talk about baby names. And then Fred sits down with us. We're like, oh, hey, Fred.
What is, did you want to go back?
I think so. I think there's like little bits I feel like I missed, but we were there 8 days. We saw some really good stuff and had some really good times, like in the things that we saw. I think one of the regrets is we didn't have you there, because a lot of times we'd be walking away from a chateau and we would be like, wow, I think I really liked it, but I would love to hear Brent's perspective. Or like, I don't know. It was very interesting, like from that perspective, because there were some, like, just to give you the rundown of like all of them, because there are some that I haven't talked about that I think are really cool that I think you'll enjoy. And then some that I'm like, I think you'll hate this. On all of these, we got a private tour that, like, most of them run tourism things at their chateaus on the side to make money. But then, like, the second floor is dedicated to the family. So, like, people are actively living in these places.
Sure.
So
that's pretty common.
I had no idea, because we're like, in my mind, it was like someone's living in a museum.
Right.
And I guess in some sense, that's what they're doing. But anyway, we were kind of blown away by that. And then, like, the level of access that we had, crazy. So the first family we went to, the Tujo family, their house was pretty. They were going under some renovations, so they were going to do some work to theirs to, like, kind of fix it up. We only saw two rooms, and we saw a lot of documents. They have, like, a lot of, like, a national archive there. Their house was, like, really cool. It's, like, probably going to be cool in, like, 2 years as they continue to work on it and fix it up. So, I don't know. Theirs is, like, good. Then the next day, we started at Chateau Balleroy. Favorite one. That one was amazing because of how well-maintained it was and so many cool features, like, along the way. Like, whenever you were afar from it, it had these two gatehouses that were not attached to it, that were literally like guard shacks. But from afar, it looked like an addition onto the home. So it looked like the chateau made a U shape, which was really cool. And they had a lot of things like that where you were like, from afar, it looks like this. Up close, it looks like this in that chateau. So that one was really cool. After that, we went to an abbey that was from, like, the tens, that was, like, really old. It had timber framing from the 1300s that they did dendrochronology on. Side note on dendrochronology. You have to have an active database from a region in order to have a dendrochronology database like that.
Dendrochronology is dating wood based on its growth rings, and there has to be a database that they compare your piece of wood to, so that they can look at it and go, well, we think it's this old because these growth rings line up. And growth rings will change based on drought, based on fires, based on different things like that.
It's actually one of the coolest things, because you'll take, like, a timber and you'll find, like, a part that's, like, just touching the bark side, and you'll take a, you know, little dry, what is it? What would you call that? Auger almost?
It's a bore, yeah.
Yeah, so you, like, bore out diagonally through this timber to get your sample, and then you take that tree ring sample and you, like, put it side by side against the database, and it runs it along, and then it goes, oh, yep, those two are, like, matched up there. There's the growth rings are aligned because there was a fire this year, or there was a, whatever. But, like, to keep that database active, you've got to have a good database. I don't know. We just don't have that in the States. Like, in Boston, we have it. But as you move further and further away from Boston, you don't have it always, like, as super
well,
far
I mean,
back.
Well, I mean, the thing is about Texas, or about things, you can begin to start dating things based on nails, based on, you know, how it was hewn, and different things like that, that we're just so much later. There's enough technology as part of, you know, the building technology that makes it easier to date. Because I don't think we need dendrochronology in Texas. I mean, you know, there's, you know, anyway, I just don't think you need
it. Well, it just gives us a good enough time. Like, if we start a database now, it's a lot easier to manage and maintain. And I think people are, like, wanting to do that.
Well, the other thing that's hard is that, you know, in Texas, you know, especially by the time of the railroads, you have lumber coming from all over the country to that space. And so it's, you don't have a regional lumber, you know, source.
No, that's a good point. That's a good point. It may not actually even matter now, because there's so many places.
So to wrap this up, one, because it's annoying to hear all about France because I didn't get to go, but two, tell us, you know, I want to encourage people to travel. So, you know, what's the takeaway?
I think the takeaway is I just learned so much from all these things. Like, I don't know. One, the biggest, like, learning was, oh, you can do this. Like, you can, this is possible. Like, when we went to Chateau Fontainebleau, like, the extravagance.
You're saying that what they do with stone and wood, and you're amazed at
what
they can craft.
Yeah, build is amazing.
Yeah.
Like, the detail in Chateau Fontainebleau, like, I did a story of it, but it was like they had this one panel that if I achieved what this panel was carved in a lifetime, I would be like, whoa, this is awesome.
A life well lived if I could have done
that. Well, like when you look at Vossel's carvings, like it would be like one of Vossel's carvings on a panel of wood. And then I zoom out and like scan this whole room, and it's like a, you know, 50 yard room with a different panel on every single face of this wall. Like, and the panels are, you know, 3 feet by a foot, just super innately carved, amazing. You can do that? Like, what? And then we walk into a room and it's a timber framed room. So you like look up and you see that the timbers all have an ornate carving, and not just an ornate carving, but an ornate carving and pattern that's been repeated to a level of perfection across every single one of the like 300 timbers in the room. Like, it made you go, whoa, there's more that like I as a craftsman could be doing. Because I'm like, oh, what if I space my dovetails differently? And that would like really set me apart. These guys are like, what if I just carve, you know, the Mona Lisa into a piece of wood and then do that 97 more times? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that's what travel should do. And that's, I mean, I hope that guys that are listening, I keep telling people, you got to travel, you got to travel, you got to travel. If you want to be a master builder, you can't do it without travel, I don't think. And so you can look at pictures and whatever, go on Pinterest, but you're not going to see it like you see it if you go there and see the scale and see the variety of what they're doing. It's just, it's inspiring.
That was one thing that I felt like when I was doing it, I took the photo. And as soon as I took the photo, I'm looking at it on my phone. I'm like, but that's not like, that's not what I'm seeing right now. And then I'd like try and take a video of what I'm seeing. I was like, it just doesn't capture it. It doesn't do it justice. And then the other thing that I'll say, like, I think like we did this trip, I've got so much to think about from this trip that I don't know if I would want to necessarily travel again for like another year or two to just like process the amount of stuff that I saw. And I'm sure like memory is going to fade or whatever, but it's like the amount of like crazy things that I saw just while traveling. And like, I know I was mentioning like we got into exclusive places, not even that, like the exclusive things that we saw, like we saw like blueprints to major, you know, buildings and stuff and like cool art pieces, but nothing like just what we saw, like walking the streets of Paris, seeing these chateaus that are open to the public, and like the, it's just crazy. Like their post office is beautiful. It's like always a reclaimed historic building. And that's something that I don't think we do well in the States, right? Like we have all these historic buildings. Oh, we should make that the governor's mansion. We should make that like the National Archives building. We don't really do that. Like I know we do it to some extent, but a lot of times it's like, well, let's hire an architect to build something new and modern and crazy rather than. Anyway, so there's a lot for me to think about, I guess, is what I want to jump back to, like, because it's a lot. Like, it's a lot to absorb
and process. I hope you had fun, damn it. I'm glad it was inspiring, and, you know, that's cool. That's good. That's what it's supposed to do.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
All right.
All right, thanks for watching this episode of the Passion for Craft podcast. We'll see you next time.